I'm Vermont Edition co-host Bob Kinzel. Just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Nearly a quarter of all the confirmed COVID cases Vermont has reported have come in the last 2 weeks. It's a spike many Vermonters naively thought couldn't or wouldn't happen here after months of very low case numbers and a suppression of the virus that was the envy of nearly every other state in the nation. But now we're facing significant viral spread. Washington County alone has had 265 cases reported to the state in the last 2 weeks, according to the COVID dashboard. New restrictions were put in place starting Saturday night for sports leagues, telework, responding to contact tracers, and the closure of bars and clubs for indoor gathering to try to address this spread of the virus throughout Vermont. But the new rule that's causing the most consternation has to do with the ban on meeting up with friends, family, and neighbors. Vermonters are allowed to go to work or school, allowed to dine in a restaurant as a family, or do their shopping. But they are not allowed to meet up and go for a walk with a neighbor, even 6 feet apart and wearing a mask. And they're not allowed to gather together for Thanksgiving with people outside of their household, or share childcare, talk around the fire pit, or anything else that involves members of a different household that it could be considered a social gathering, a non-work situation, a non-school situation. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to get more clarity on why the governor imposed these rules and why the health department supports them. And we're going to try to get to the bottom of what some people feel is an unfair burden or incongruous with rules that allow restaurants and other things to stay open. At the end of the hour, we're also going to get an update on the vaccine trial UVM Medical Center is participating in. Tracy Dolan, Vermont's Deputy Health Commissioner, joins us now. Deputy Commissioner Dolan, thank you very much for taking the time to join us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
So let's start with some of those new regulations I mentioned, and I'll go through a couple of them. Sports leagues have been suspended. This does not apply to school-based sports, however, which are governed under a different set of rules. And I imagine the state state education agency is still looking at those and still thinking about them. But sports leagues have been suspended. Bars and clubs are no longer allowed to have in-person service. They can still do curbside or takeout service, including takeout alcohol. Restaurants need to close for in-person service at 10 p.m. People are expected to work from home, telework, in whatever capacity is possible, including things like staff meetings or meeting up with other colleagues, which may have been being done in person. That is expected to be stopped now, and people should be working from home wherever possible. And the state is compelling people to answer the phone if a contact tracer calls you and asking Vermonters to be forthright about all of their movements and whereabouts when a contact tracer asks them about it. But as I mentioned, the one rule that I think is hardest for Vermonters, even those who plan on complying, because this is a rule, it has the force of law, is that prohibition on any multifamily gatherings. And of course, everybody's situation is so specific. But Deputy Commissioner, it does feel to many like they're being unfairly burdened when some of the activities they would like to engage in are ones that the health department has been saying are safe, like walks 6 feet apart from another neighbor while wearing masks. So why is the rule laid out the way it is? Understanding that you're not the governor.
Yeah, no, thanks for the question. You know, I just want to pull back and give us some context. Throughout this pandemic, we have really been learning as we go and adjusting policies as we go to fit Vermont circumstance. And for a lot of the pandemic, we had the luxury of having very low rates, in part because of the great work we did early on in this pandemic. And I think it can feel very surprising or very rigid to people to suddenly see this shift again. But what we saw, we knew a surge would come. So we saw the modeling early on across the country. We saw cases getting out of control, Connecticut and Rhode Island. I mean, their healthcare systems are absolutely under pressure now and at a real crisis point. So we saw it coming. But what really surprised us was the speed with which we started doubling our cases. It happened in a very short period. And so we had to move and do something pretty strong, stronger than almost any other state, in order to try to get a halt, because what happens is you put a policy in place and you have a 2-week lag time. So all of those policies that you just went through, the theme there is trying to keep people in a place where they're not able to transmit, because the virus hasn't changed at all. Our behavior started to loosen, and that's what got the virus moving again. That virus wants to move, right? And so what we have now is a policy structure set in place so that we minimize our circles, at least for the next month. I think this emergency order is in through December 15th, mm-hmm. to see if we can slow this down. And so the theme there is the unstructured environments in particular. That's where we've been seeing this surge come from, these informal gatherings. You know, 70% of our cases are coming from those. I know people were frustrated about people traveling in from outside, but really we are the problem and we hold the solution.
So, okay, so understanding that that's the broad-based reasoning and the data behind it, that set more than 70% of cases from October 1st to last Friday could be attributed to gatherings, sort of in private and in public. So some of them, the state has said, were in maybe a bar or a club. Some of them may have been in another person's backyard. But understanding that, what to that specific, you know, even during the lockdown, people were encouraged to go out and get exercise, which, you know, they're still allowed to do. But people would maybe walk with their neighbors at a safe distance and find that way to have some connection to somebody else that felt safe and wasn't discouraged, you know, didn't seem to be driving transmission, and now even that is not allowed.
Yeah, so this first glance at this policy that was just delivered a few days ago, this executive order, you see the broad restrictions. And now what the team is doing is working on some clarification to speak to people's questions coming up around this. So you should see in the next few days, I know ACCD, our Commerce Department, is working on now more specific nuanced guidance to fit some of these circumstances. The goal is still the same. Don't get together in multi-household gatherings, but we recognize, of course, that the policy doesn't necessarily speak to every individual circumstance. And like you said earlier, sometimes we do need to do a hammer rather than a scalpel, because you can't go in and dictate in every home. And so you should see some clarification coming out the next few days that will hopefully be able to answer a few of these questions and offer a little more nuanced guidance.
Bear with us, Deputy Commissioner. I think we're going to get a lot of questions today that are sort of individual in nature or apply to someone's specific circumstance. But I also think they'll be helpful and informative to Vermonters who are trying to parse this and maybe trying to figure out, you know, how do I live my life? How do I actually keep a job, which the governor has said is a priority, if I can't do X, Y, or Z? And so, you know, there may be some sort of duplicative responses, but we'll go through some of them. And then we're also going to talk about other things today as well as listeners send us questions. But let's start with Cheryl Joy, who's calling in from Chester. Hi, Cheryl Joy. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. I also thank you for all the hard work that you both are doing. I wonder, this is probably appropriate for a lot of people in Vermont. We're homeschoolers, and we have been gathering outside only and using masks and keeping more than 6 feet distance when, you know, most of the time. And I wonder, now, schools are open and for in-person learning, as are school-based sports. So I wonder where homeschoolers fit into this, since we are actually multifamily gathering, but we're gathering for schooling, actually.
Cheryl, that's a good question, and I'll also tack on to that we're getting questions, Deputy Commissioner, from people who are doing similar pod-type schooling on remote days, even if their children are enrolled in the public school system, but for schools that are doing hybrid learning or when schools go remote, that this is a network of schooling and childcare so that families can continue to keep their jobs. So to Cheryl's question, you know, is sort of school-based learning, if it can be conducted in certain ways, is that something the state might look at? Because it sounds like under the current guidelines, no, not allowed, right?
Under the current guidelines as written, multiple household social gatherings. However, it does not call out educational gatherings. I believe that the school gatherings that are currently replacing a formal school, so if you are home-based and you're homeschooled and that group is coming together in the same way that you have really clear regulations at the school. I believe those regulations also apply to a homeschool environment. And as far as I know, that is still allowed. But I believe that there is a team working on specifying and getting more clear about the guidance so that it will speak to these cases. But if you do read through the executive order, it states attendance at all public and private social, recreational, and entertainment gatherings, indoor and outdoor, including large social gatherings incidental to ceremony, holiday gatherings, etc. It does not call out an educational environment. And to the best of my knowledge, the educational environment is still falling within the other educational guidelines, in which case you're supposed to be 6 feet apart, masked, et cetera.
Okay, so just to be clear, the situation that Cheryl is describing would be allowed.
You know, I'm going to caveat a lot of answers today because I know there's a team working on additional regulations, and I would ask you to revisit that. But according to the current executive order, it does not call out educational environment, and I believe that the homeschool environment continues to be guided by the regulations that also guide regular school environments.
Would that also apply to families that are doing sort of pod-based ad hoc learning groups based on their school's hybrid learning model?
The answer right now is I don't know, but I can tell you, for example, that my child goes to another home for tutoring, and that stopped this week because that is a multiple household gathering. You know, Dr. Levine read a great statement from Monica Ogilvie. She's one of our contact tracers at the Department of Health. And her statement was, do I need to be within 6 feet? Do I need to gather? And so in the case of the regular educational programs that are replacing a school program, that's one thing. If they're additional or enhancing a program, right now I would say those are suspended until further notice.
Similarly, there are childcare arrangements are a problem for many people. Sort of center-based childcare, official childcare arrangements. Those childcare centers, preschools and elementary schools, are by and large open, although, you know, it certainly varies on a case-by-case basis and with what happens with cases. People who have different childcare arrangements are really struggling right now, again, to keep their jobs under what the governor has said is a priority, but who now feel like, you know, I'm not allowed to send my child to a private childcare arrangement, which may have been another family member who's not in my household. What can you tell us about that?
Again, the best I can say is that this guidance really applies to those social gatherings. Again, remembering what drove our numbers, it was adults getting together primarily for small parties, for social gatherings. So to the best of my knowledge, and again, there's a team working on the details of this, this guidance shouldn't affect regular childcare environments, regular educational structures like homeschooling, going to school, those kinds of things. This guidance should not have an impact on.
So let's go to Maggie, who's calling in from Morristown. Maggie, I hadn't seen your call, but does that answer your question about childcare?
Yeah, I was thinking I might hang up, but yeah, that was my question. I mean, I provide childcare in my home one day a week for my two nieces and our neighbor, you know, and so their parents can go to work. And I'm wondering if that's okay. We're all trying to do the right thing, and there just hasn't been much guidance on that.
Yeah, so Deputy Commissioner Dolan, Maggie should still be able to provide that childcare?
From the best of my knowledge, again, pending additional guidance, there may be more guidance that comes out to specify that. But according to the executive order right now, it really is focused on those social gatherings, not the necessities. We recognize that childcare is necessary. Education is necessary, particularly for those who are not going to school if they are in a homeschool environment. But unnecessary gatherings, adult gatherings, the multiple household, that really the emphasis that Dr. Levine and the governor was placing was really focusing on the social gatherings.
Let's go to Peter in Barrie. Hi, Peter. What's your question?
My question. Yes, I was wondering, I live alone, and I was wondering if I could visit my friends. Or I kind of think maybe I shouldn't. I'm not sure if I can or if it's recommended or not.
Yeah, Peter, thanks for the question. So Deputy Commissioner Dolan, I'll read from the addendum to the executive order here, which states individuals who live alone may gather with members of their immediate family residing in a different household. So Peter said, may I visit friends, plural. Maybe we could talk about what is intended by that specification of immediate family residing in a different household, and then how might Peter apply that to his own situation. Regardless, it sounds like friends more than one household would absolutely not be allowed under the guidelines.
That's right. And again, there is more clarification coming along. We recognize there are some people who live alone in a household, but as the executive order stands, it is multiple household gatherings. So in this case, that would be against the executive order. We recognize that people in an individual household may need more clarification to determine how to apply this to their lives. But gathering with friends who are from different households is not allowed under this executive order.
Yeah, that question of immediate family, I mean, it doesn't say biological, but it does say immediate. And so there are people who have been, you know, checking in with me saying, what if I don't live with my partner and we're not married, so legally we're not considered, a household or immediate family, but can I still visit my partner and have that be my one person? Or people who say, I don't have any immediate family here. And in fact, that's going to contribute to more loneliness if I can't even visit one chosen friend or sort of chosen family. Sounds like more clarification may be forthcoming on Friday about that.
Yeah, more clarification. We recognize social isolation is an issue. We are really trying to balance, and I think you said it well earlier, this hammer versus scalpel, but we're really trying to balance slowing down this transmission with people's needs. And we recognize there's going to be some hard times over the next few weeks. We don't want it to be unduly hard for an individual who has no family. And so you will probably see some clarification to help people interpret this. But really, we are, we learned from Canada 2 weeks after Thanksgiving there, their cases doubled. And we believe that was about multiple household social gatherings. And we saw here around Halloween, we were so focused on helping kids make tubes and run their candy out the door. I think we were all so focused on that. And you almost forget that adults like to really party. I had no idea Halloween was this popular until we saw the surge. Turns out everyone was at a Halloween party. And so, you know, that really drove numbers. And so sometimes you have to really put in a strong statement and a strong line in order to get us back on track. But obviously there's a few questions coming up and we'll be able to add more clarification. I don't want to get out ahead of the governor and his team, but I imagine that in a few days you will see a little more clarification to help people apply this to circumstances that might not be as apparent as described right now.
Couldn't the state just say, don't drink with anybody else and don't eat?
You know, they could, but it's interesting. I know a lot of people are concerned about, walking with someone outside, and people had a lot of questions about that. And it does seem like, well, of course, you'd walk, you'd stay 6 feet away and wear a mask. And while some people do that, I don't know if you've been out hiking at all, but I know Governor Scott has. And on the trails, he sees large groups of people, sometimes unmasked, gathering beforehand, going on a hike, gathering afterwards. And so it does get tricky to separate it out. And so I believe that's why he's really trying to make some of these strong statements so that people truly understand that it's really, it becomes a slippery slope. And so we're trying as much as we can to make some clear statements. And so hopefully more clarification will help with some of those questions.
Let me go back to Peter. Peter, you just called in from Barrie and you said you live alone. You wanted to know if you could visit friends and you were thinking it sounded like you couldn't. You know, the guidelines are pretty clear in saying you can't visit friends. Although I think, it sounds like you may be able, especially once there's more clarification, to choose one other person to sort of be your non-living together household. Does that work for you? How are you thinking that you'll make it through the next several weeks, Peter?
I don't have any family in Vermont either,
Yeah.
So, to visit. So I don't know. I was actually feeling a little anxious about it, being alone and not being able to visit anybody, But I, you still can go out and shop and stuff and I can use the phone, so I can still contact over the phone, so that's good.
Yeah, Peter, absolutely. Yeah, and it sounds like you will be able to maybe choose one person to be your person through this time, because as Deputy Commissioner says, Deputy Commissioner Dolan says, there's a lot of concern about people who are socially isolated. And, you know, it sounds like you will be able to get in touch with people by phone and in other ways to stay connected. But that ability to have someone to see who you feel connected to, I know, is an important one. So I hope you are able to find that one person. Let's go to Barbara, who's calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Barbara. Go right ahead.
Hey, Tracy. Thank you very much for your good work and all that. My question is probably represents more than just me, although it's also about me and my family. We all, myself, my husband, and three adult children who live in Vermont but not with us, two adult children, test coronavirus in March. We were never tested because at the time there were not enough testing supplies, but we all were quarantined and followed by our doctor every day. Since then, we've all been giving blood through the American Red Cross regularly and regularly continue to test positive for coronavirus antibodies. In fact, most recently, just a couple weeks ago, and I'm scheduled to donate convalescent plasma in mid-December. So my question is, I know you can't give me any assessment of risk advice, but more from a policy perspective, are there going to be any nuanced guidelines for those of us who have positive antibodies for coronavirus and continue to do so? Can we do different things? Can we get together for Thanksgiving, for example, you know, in accordance with guidelines? Or will you guys be addressing something that I think is probably a growing number of people who may be positive for antibodies for the coronavirus?
Yeah, Barbara, and thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead. Your second question.
One tiny other second question is, do you have any information whatsoever on whether, even if we are likely, and I know it's not necessarily so, to be unable to get it at this moment, do you have any information on whether we can somehow give it to people?
Okay, so a couple of questions there, Deputy Commissioner. So the first one is, could someone like Barbara, who has tested positive for COVID-19 antibodies, be allowed to have different rules than those who have not contracted the virus, with the idea that someone like Barbara couldn't get or pass the virus along?
That's a great question. Here's what we know, that the antibody response that you have, so clearly you have an antibody response and that's showing up in tests, we don't know how strong that is. So it's difficult for us to say that, Barbara, you're immune. It's not possible for you to either pass it on or to get it. We wouldn't know that for sure at this point. And so that's one of the challenges. But the much bigger challenge in your question is, if we had the ability to, again, kind of use a scalpel, like Jane mentioned earlier, we might be able to say this group of people has this antibody response, therefore we know that they have this level of immunity, therefore they can get together. That would be a wonderful thing. We simply don't have that level of data about Vermonters, and so we will not be able to get that tailored or specific with our guidance. So the guidance that says multiple families can't get together for Thanksgiving or for any celebration would apply to you regardless of your antibody status.
And the question of whether Barbara could still pass the virus along?
That's unknown. That data is still emerging. What we know about antibody response is that it tends to be stronger at the beginning and it tends to wane over time. What we don't know in this case is 6 months a long time or not. You know, there's not a lot of work done on this. This is still emerging. We do know that the vaccines that are coming out will be 90 to 95% effective so far based on the trials. And we know that those vaccines are specifically engineered to last a long time. What I don't know is Barbara's antibody response, how much virus she had initially in her blood, and therefore the strength of that response.
We're getting a couple of questions about guidance related to shared custody and children who live in more than one household. And I'll, Jeffrey, I know you're calling in from East Montpelier, but I'm going to read Sean's email just for the sake of brevity. Sean says, I currently have a friend living with me in my house after a divorce. He has a joint custody arrangement that includes the children moving between the two households multiple times per week and going to school and daycare. Sean writes, am I correct in my understanding that this is still allowed under the current guidance?
Yes, this is still allowed. We absolutely prioritize children being with their parents. We recognize that children who have two different parents need to move about. I'm in that circumstance as well. My kids spend half their time with me and half the time with their dad. And the state has recognized that from the beginning, that that's essential for children's health and well-being.
Does that also apply to children who may be traveling across state borders, which was my situation as a child? You know, do children who are visiting one parent in Vermont and or living with one parent some of the time in Vermont and some of the time in another state, how is that negotiated?
That is still allowed. What we would, of course, strongly encourage is that during that travel, you limit that as much as possible, decrease any chance of contacts outside of the vehicle if you're driving, et cetera. But we are not going to interfere with or interrupt the important visitation of children with their parents. But anything you can do to reduce the risk, obviously, is great for you and great for the state and the population.
Akshata emailed in to say, I've been looking to apply for a contact health tracer job to help the state out in managing this virus. I run a healthcare center and work as a nutritionist. I can't find any information online about how to apply for such a position right now. I see the hiring freeze on state websites, but I hear in press conferences that more robust contact tracing is necessary and the current teams might become overwhelmed. How can I get my hands on an application?
Sure, and that's an application to become a contact tracer?
Correct, yes.
We're actually in a pretty good spot. We've been working on surge planning for this for a few months. We knew that we were going to be increasing our cases. Again, it happened a little more quickly than anticipated. So we already had our VDH contact tracers.
Vermont Department of Health.
Vermont Department of Health contact tracers. We've hired in contact tracers through an employment agency. And we have actually hired some additional contact tracers from some communities, but we're also taking in a lot of people from the state and redeploying them as well, and National Guard. So right now, our plan seems to be in pretty good shape. I do not think we've put out an open call for applications, but if we do, you should see that on the Department of Human Resources website, and we would certainly post it on our website too. But we are not putting out a public call for applications at this time. We are sourcing it in a variety of ways, and so far we seem to be getting what we need.
And are contact tracers getting what they need in terms of compliance from close contacts who are being attempted to be traced?
So a few months ago, I would have said, absolutely. It's
right.
Amazing, actually. I mean, at the beginning, I was amazed. I mean, it was so rare. It would be a conference call to talk about one person who didn't want to be compliant. I mean, it was so unusual. And now, unfortunately, we're getting people not picking up. We're getting people who are frustrated and want to resist. And, you know, what's difficult is when you don't feel sick, when you feel fine, you don't want to pick up the phone, find out that you're close contact, and find out that you have to quarantine. But you actually really do have to pick up the phone, have that conversation, and then you do have to quarantine. And we are getting more people who are resisting. And so I'm hoping the governor's plea, these new policies, and really the real part that will drive behavior, I believe, is people looking around and realizing our cases are going up. But not only that, our hospitalizations are increasing. And while not in Vermont, in many parts of the country, we're starting to see a rise in deaths again. And the mortality rates are going up. And so I hope people, that's a real eye-opener for people, and they recognize that they're putting themselves at risk. But in particular, you know, we've got cases in long-term care facilities again, and we tried so hard to keep a wall around that area so that they would be protected. So I really hope people realize it just doesn't take too many, what do we call that, the cases of separation. It doesn't take too many of those generations of separation to be reaching someone who's truly in a very vulnerable place.
Well, speaking of people who are in long-term care facilities, I think that may be part of Emily's question. Emily's calling in from Waterbury. Go right ahead, Emily.
Hi. I have a grandparent in one of those long-term care facilities, and they just released a policy that residents are allowed to leave, have the Thanksgiving meal with their families, and if they return in under 24 hours, they don't have to quarantine. I'm wondering whether we're going to see state guidance on this. It feels like that's pretty risky and sort of contradictory to what we've been hearing so far. So I wonder if we can expect additional state guidance on long-term care.
Yeah, Emily, I heard Human Services Secretary Mike Smith talking about new guidance and changes for long-term care facilities and sort of tightening those restrictions. But it was a little bit unclear to me whether that was mandatory or voluntary and where. So what can you tell us, Deputy Commissioner Dolan?
Sure. The situation you just described, I would be very surprised if that is maintained. I'm guessing with the new regulations that came out, again, I don't know the timing of that guidance that just came in from the long-term care facility you're referring to. I will certainly, after this phone call, check in with the Department of Aging and Independent Living and make sure all of our long-term care facilities are clear. But it would not be safe for a resident of a long-term care facility to leave, go have Thanksgiving with a family, and then return. That would be ill-advised, and so I will be checking in about that. But as far as I know, the long-term care facilities are also, of course, very concerned. They are seeing some cases in their facilities. They're doing regular testing, and I doubt that that would hold, and hopefully that's an exception.
And let's hear from Patrick in Fletcher. Hi, Patrick.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
Hi, I was listening to the press conference, and I was struck by I think it was like the second to the last question when the man asked the governor something to the effect that masks and social distancing didn't work. His science indicated that masks and social distancing didn't work. And the governor shot right back at him that, yes, they do work. And then he said, well, you should check your numbers. And the governor said, no, I'm not going to check my numbers. And so I'm wondering if he accidentally hit on the real problem here, that you have about half the country led by a president who don't believe that masks and social distancing work. But so I'm wondering if you could actually speak to the science behind whether or not masks work, and how do you reach the population of people who don't believe the science?
Yeah, Patrick, good point, because even if we have Deputy Commissioner Dolan address the science, to your point, you know, there are people who are going to say that's not true, or that's not what I've read, or, you know, I just don't think I believe you. So, you know, how do you address both of those points, Tracy Dolan? You know, what the science actually says, and then how do you get to people who say, no, it doesn't?
Sure. I guess I'll first address the science. We absolutely know that masks and social distancing work. And the definition of work, of course, is not 100%. These are mitigating actions that we take. And we know that if we take multiple mitigating actions, it brings down our risk. Is it 100%? No. You could be wearing a mask. You could be 6 feet away. And if you were in an enclosed room for a long period, you may contract COVID. However, the 6 foot and the mask would significantly reduce your chances. One or the other may not. It's really both at the same time. And then, of course, hand washing, staying home when you're sick. What we have is a variety of tools in our toolbox, and we have to use all of them.
So I've seen it described as the Swiss cheese method, that, you know, there may be a few holes if you're just using one, but the more layers you have, the less likely it is that the virus will be able to get through all of the different holes in your cheese slice prevention methods.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's actually just classic public health. In public health, it's rare that one thing works for everything. We do this in public health. We say we've got to do a variety of things. I mean, think about your own health. To stay healthy, you can't just do one thing. It's not just exercising. It's exercising. It's eating well. It's making sure that you maintain your mental health. There's a variety of things you
get enough sleep.
And that's the get enough sleep, doing it all. But it is science. It's not about believing. I mean, you can choose to believe there's a moon, but there is a moon, regardless of your belief. This is science. And I think he makes a great point. Leadership is key. Here in Vermont, one of the reasons that we have done so well, and I know we're in a surge right now, but I absolutely believe we can bring that down, is because we had leadership that has been leading with science. We obviously have leadership at the federal level that has not been leading with science, and we have really no clear plan or guidance at the federal level, and states are scrambling. We are lucky that we have a governor that wanted to lead with the science. We have states that are not, and they are in a much worse situation in some cases. It's exciting to think that in January, we actually have an advisory team that's being built now, from what it seems, that will actually have a plan. And it will be helpful, I think, for the whole population of the country to start hearing at a leadership level, reinforcing this. Because, you know, you get information from so many different sources. You get it from your friends, from the internet, from leadership, from the federal government, from your state government. So all of that will help. But you're right. And I think the governor spoke well. This idea of patriotism, and real patriotism is doing what you need to do for your fellow countrymen, and in this case, for fellow Vermonters. Whether or not you believe it, it works. And it's you know, we have a minimum set of tools and we have to use all of them.
This is our weekly health update, and we're talking with Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan. But before we go back to her and other questions that you have for her, we thought we'd take a few minutes learning about a COVID-19 vaccine trial that's underway in Vermont. Last month, it was announced that the University of Vermont Medical Center and Vaccine Testing Center at the University of Vermont's Larner College of Medicine had been selected to participate in a Phase 3 trial for an Oxford University AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine. Phase 3 is the final phase in the vaccine testing process. The trial launched last Tuesday, and here to tell us more about it is Dr. Kristen Pierce, a clinical infectious disease specialist at the University of Vermont and one of the trial's sub-investigators. Dr. Pierce, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks, Jane. It's really nice to be here.
Well, I'm glad that we have a chance to talk with you because I think this has been of interest to many people. You know, who's participating? What is it? What's happening? And how does it coincide with what we're hearing about other vaccines that are showing significant progress? So let's first talk about what it is that the trial that UVM Medical Center and Larner College of Medicine are participating in actually is. What is this trial?
Yeah, so this is, as you said, this is AstraZeneca's vaccine, also known as the Oxford vaccine, because it was developed at, by researchers at Oxford University in England. And this is, as you said, a phase three study. This is a national and international study. So it's conducted in the U.S., and it's also in sites in India, Brazil, South Africa, and ongoing in England as well. And the hope is to enroll 30,000 volunteers in the U.S. alone in this phase three study. Here in Vermont, we are hoping to enroll about 250 people. That's what we've been asked to enroll by the study sponsors.
And do you have all of them?
Not yet, but the response after the initial press announcement at the governor's press conference a couple weeks ago has been overwhelming. The Burlington and Greater Burlington community is an amazing global-minded community. And we've had an overwhelming response and interest in the study. So that's really been phenomenal.
Are you still looking for more volunteers, or is that part of it sort of closed at this point?
No, we're still looking for volunteers. So if people are interested, yes, please. We're still looking for volunteers.
And you're looking especially for people who have comorbidities, who have other issues, other health issues, or who are older and presumably more vulnerable to COVID-19. Talk a little bit about who you're actually hoping will enroll in this, or what types of people within the population you maybe need more volunteers from.
We are looking for people that are most at risk for getting COVID, so COVID exposure, and also at risk for developing complications from COVID, so severe disease. So those would be frontline healthcare workers, essential workers, older people, people over the age of 60, 65, people with underlying medical conditions, things like diabetes, heart disease, underlying lung disease like emphysema or asthma.
And are you looking for members of different racial and ethnic communities as well?
Yes, and COVID has disproportionately affected many of those communities in terms of illness and disease and morbidity and mortality. And the hope is to really make sure that all populations, anyone that wants to be included in the study, is offered the chance to enroll and be part of the study.
So can you just tell us a little bit, too, about what a study participant is doing? They're either getting the vaccine or a placebo, right?
Correct. And people are randomized, so allocated to receive either a placebo or a vaccine. And we at the University of Vermont Medical Center, we don't know what people are getting. That is conducted by the study sponsors, so we don't know who receives what. And it's a ratio of 2-1. So for every 2 volunteers that receive the vaccine, 1 person receives the placebo, which is basically a saline injection, so not active drug.
And just to be clear, the participants will be informed once the study is completely over about which one they had so they can make better informed decisions for themselves.
That is absolutely correct, Jane, yes.
So, you know, what we've been hearing about at least 2 different vaccines, I believe, is that these types of studies are showing remarkable promise, a remarkable effectiveness rate. And, you know, the effectiveness rate as I understand it, that's needed for approval is at least 50%. And these two are showing initial results much higher than that, a much higher rate of success. So how does the vaccine trial that UVM is participating in sort of coincide or work or conflict with these other vaccine trials we've been hearing about?
Yeah, that's such an important question. And I will say when the initial Pfizer results were announced, one of the main researchers at the National Institutes of Health, who's part of this COVID research network, said it's a wonderful day for science, recognizing that any vaccine that we can bring to market that's safe and effective in this global pandemic is going to be, it's going to feel like a huge win for the world of science. And I think what these two studies so far, the Pfizer study and the Moderna study, have shown us is that the technology that we're using to develop these vaccines, using that spike protein, that piece of the genetic material, a piece of it, of the COVID, of the virus itself, as part of these vaccines, is working. And that is huge. It's a huge, huge leap, success, if you will, for vaccine science. So, and I think that it's important to recognize we're probably going to need more than one vaccine. If you look at the Pfizer vaccine, although very, very effective, has to be kept at a very, very cold temperature. So that might be a great vaccine for a large medical center that has a freezer that can keep something that's very, very cold like that, but not, might not work for rural hospitals or small community outreach clinics. So it's not, we don't see it as a competition. We see it as an overall win for science that these vaccines are working.
So, in other words, you're still continuing. You're continuing on with this trial, and you know the fact that others may be even closer to market than the Oxford vaccine is not a problem, given what we know about the entire population of the world that is going to try to get vaccinated.
Right. Right. And I think, you know, I don't have a crystal ball, but in hearing other people talk about when the vaccines, you know, for something like Pfizer or Moderna's vaccine might be available for the initial rollout, I don't think anyone's estimating it beyond, you know, maybe the beginning to mid 2021 for the most vulnerable. And then it could be even later for those populations that are not, you know, as vulnerable to severe disease. Again, I don't have a crystal ball, but it doesn't seem like it's going to be tomorrow. So,
Jackie in Colchester wrote in to say, I'm in the age group they're looking for this study, and I have asthma. I submitted a pre-screening form just as the computer system went down, and I'm wondering if that's why I have yet to hear anything. Dr. Pierce, has the cyber attack that's affecting so many systems at UVM Medical Center affected anything with your trial as well?
Yes, and I would say to that person who wrote in, yes, absolutely, and we're sorry that it has taken a while to get back to people, but the cyber attack definitely impacted our ability to contact people, and our phone systems went down. Most of the study documentation was supposed to be electronic, and just like the hospital has done, we pivoted to paper. We did it very quickly with the support of UVM Medical Center, but it definitely has affected our ability to get back to people. So please be patient. We will get back to you, I promise.
One last question for you, Dr. Pierce, just briefly. You know, given how fast these vaccine trials are going, how much confidence do you have that a vaccine would have long-term effectiveness, or will there need to be more studies done to see if people need further doses?
So that's a great question, Jane. I mean, I think the dosing piece, we don't know yet, right? We don't know if this will be something that you get once and like a measles shot, you get it, you're good, or if it will be something where similar to the annual influenza vaccine where you have to get a COVID shot every year. We don't fully know that. And so the longer term studies will help us figure that piece out. I will say a lot of attention has been paid to the pace of this vaccine development, and it has raised, I think, questions in the community about whether these vaccines are safe. And I would just like to say that it's very important to point out that the pace of the vaccine development is more accelerated than we've seen in the past. But this is an unprecedented event. The entire globe is looking for an effective and safe vaccine. So the amount of scientific person power that has gone into this is enormous. And just because the process has been a little bit more speeded up, I also think it's important to note that the normal safety checks that are in place for any therapeutic development, a drug, a device, a vaccine, have not been tampered with, the safety checks are, if anything, more stringent because there's so much focus and attention paid on this. So I myself would feel comfortable getting any one of these three vaccines that are out so far, and I would say that for my family members as well.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us a little bit more about what's happening with the trial that you're working on. I really appreciate it, Dr. Pierce.
Thanks so much, Jane, and stay safe.
Yeah, you too. That's Dr. Kristen Pierce, a clinical infectious disease specialist at the University of Vermont and one of the sub-investigators with the Phase 3 COVID-19 vaccine trial underway at the medical center. Before we let you go, Tracy Dolan, you know, there's so much swirling concern and swirling information out there and so much misinformation out there, as we've talked about as well. We're going to get more clarification from the governor on Friday. Any final tips to Vermonters as they're thinking about this Thanksgiving holiday and how to prepare safely but also feel connected?
Sure. Remember that when you're keeping your circle small, when you're sticking to your home, as much as it's difficult not to be with relatives, you're also doing a great thing for your neighbors and for your community. Again, hopefully this is the only holiday season where we'll have to do something like this. And I encourage you to try to make it as joyful as you can. Use the phone, use Zoom, do what you need to do. But, you know, we are capable of amazing things. I mean, look at the massive behavior change we saw in March and April. It means we have to go back to some of that. But doing that allows us to keep kids in school. It allows us to keep a lot of businesses open. So when we're doing all this, we're doing it for ourselves, for our neighbors, but we're also doing it for the whole state and for the economy.
Before we really let you go, where can children get a flu vaccine outside of their pediatrician's office? You mentioned kids, a lot of people still trying to access the flu vaccine.
Yeah, well, pharmacists are now able to give flu vaccine in Vermont. There was an update to the PrEP Act federally, so that's another place. But reach out to your primary care office. We have distributed thousands of flu vaccine. We have an incentive program for primary care providers, including pediatricians, to really promote flu vaccine. So reach out to your pediatrician first. And if that doesn't work, reach out to your pharmacy, because I know there are several pharmacies that have picked this up as well.
Yes, some but not all, it sounds like.
It sounds like that to us as well. Yeah.
Deputy Commissioner, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today late because of the governor's press conference. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. Take care.